It's a real pleasure for me to introduce to you today my old friend and new colleague, Val Vogren, who just joined us teaching at SIUE right across the river. I think it's really difficult to introduce your friends because you want so much to convey how special they are to you and how much you admire their writing and their keen intelligence, their wit and their warmth, and of course all that's impossible to do really well. 2 minutes and mere words could not convey to you the Val experience. And then also when your friends are writers and you do a reading and they introduce you, which happened to me last month, and they praise you to the heavens and raise the bar for introductions about as high as they can go, you really left with no place to go. So I think I'm going to go that last step and sort of promote the divinity of Val and something akin to worship, which I think we should all undertake, and we can start doing that tonight. I'm here tonight to encourage you to worship in the cult of Val. Let's just call it the cult of Val. And clearly many of you are. A lot of Val's new colleagues are here from many different disciplines. You know, they're not just English, those English people that you throw rocks at. You're asking me how you're going to perform this worship, and I'm here to tell you it's pretty easy. First, one reads her forthcoming novel, Shebang, which is coming out from the University Press of Mississippi this March, right? And then one reads it again and again, I think on a sort of a daily basis, and those are your daily devotionals. If one wants to prove that devotion at an early stage, one pre-orders it on Amazon.com, perhaps right after this reading. And of course, if one is truly devoted and thinking locally, one pre-orders it at Left Bank Books, which is the finest bookstore in the world. I got a plug for Left Bank just in this, like a paragraph away. But that was a really bad moment for me. Thank you. You go from applause to the heckling. You're probably asking yourself how the worshiper, are going to fill the empty days and those aching nights until Shebang is published. And I would suggest to you that you could track down the stories that she's published in New Orleans Review, or the Crescent Review, or Black Warrior Review, or Playboy, or the Carolina Quarterly. Perhaps the devoted acolyte, realizing that Val is taught in the prestigious Gotham Writers Workshop, will walk across the street to Left Bank Books. Pick up the Gotham Writer's Workshop Guide to Writing Fiction for her chapter on Point of View, which is pretty amazing. Perhaps you're asking, why? Why would I want to become embroiled in the cult of Val? Certainly not just because she's received her MFA from the University of Alabama, because then you might have to worship in other cults, you know, the cult of Tony Early, and that's a scary cult. Perhaps one decides that one is not going to worship her just because while there she won prestigious awards, including the Alumni Fiction Award, a teaching writing fellowship, and two fellowships from the Graduate Council. It's certainly not just because she's been nominated for a Pushcart Prize or because she won the extraordinarily competitive Playboy College Fiction Prize. Really, the only reason to commit yourself to the cult of Val is so that you can enter into the mysteries and delights of her fiction. Quirky characters who, as is Byron Kerman here? Oh, that's a shame, because he can tell me how to pronounce this. Who said in the Riverfront Times, I lost the train of that sentence, the delights of her fiction, quirky characters who, as Byron Kerman in the Riverfront Times puts it, are a swamp in anemone. I always want to say anemone, you know, but which is a totally different picture. You're going to want to lose yourself in prose that is tough and haunting and stays with you for years. You're going to want to lose yourself in stories that walk that fine line between humor and heartbreak. And I think that you can become a convert really quickly, right now. Join the cult of Val by doing the simplest thing possible, which is sitting back and listening to some great fiction. Please join me in welcoming Valerie Vogren.
Okay, now you've raised the bar just a little too high. I don't think I can go there. I'll echo Eric's thanks to River Styx and to Duff's and to my new friends and old friends and people I'll never see again for coming out tonight in this cold evening. I will be reading from my forthcoming novel, Shebang, which, and because of the time restrictions, I'm just going to read from the very beginning opening section, because otherwise it would become quickly incomprehensible. There's 16 major characters and two babies, which are minor characters, and two cats, who are two more major characters. And the household, like, goes from the two people who, the main people you'll meet here, to like eight people, and everything fortunately takes place in a 3-mile radius, and so that's the only thing that kind of holds it all together. But anyway, so Finn sometimes stood across the street to take it all in, face to face with the house she'd lived in since she was 4 days old. The house was white with bright red shutters and red trim and a green front door, and from where she stood it looked as pretty and glossy as hard candy or new buttons. The porch was long and broad, its roof supported by 3 slender pillars. She and Hector had furnished the porch so completely that it seemed to be an actual room with the front wall cut away. To the left, a turquoise formica table and 4 not-quite companion chairs sat on a white, blue woven rug. A mustard-yellow couch spanned the windows and rear wall, and a brass floor lamp stood between it and a good-sized purple chair. A white coffee cup rested on one of the wide, flat arms of the chair. Something moved on the roof, and Finn glanced up, expecting to see Hazel, would-be feline huntress, stalking a squirrel, real or imagined. But it was Hector, her nephew. Nephew. That nonsense sneeze of a word. Hector crouched, heels pressed, on the very edge of the roof. He had a red pencil clenched in his teeth. Folded sharply into thirds, he looked like an origami sculpture of a too-tall boy, tucked into the gutter. His darting arms startled her. He plucked a shingle from the roof and flung it toward the driveway. Then he saw her. Their gaze met briefly as they followed the shingle, watched it strike the left-hand corner of the magnetic sign, Sweet Leaf Catering, affixed to the side panel of the station wagon. A pause, then the sign swung loose and the bottom hit the driveway with a clang. Their eyes met again, a moment or two when either of them could have hollered, "What in the hell are you doing?" Instead, Hector scrabbled backwards, leapt into the tree beside the house, and disappeared into a violent shaking of leaves. Finn bet that if her grandmother, Reed, had had a chance to consider it in the moments before her death, she would have been certain she'd left things in damn fine order. A ship-shaped button-down will with a brass tax executor, a roof paid for over their heads. She'd instilled in her great-grandson, Hector, an aversion to bad grooming, hasty decisions, and drinking liquor, 3 things she knew could drag even a good man down. She provided Finn with a livelihood and a 27-year-long example of the best way for things to be done. Pity the best way rankled, so rigid and deferential. Most often what satisfied was ignoring Reed's ways, watching the matriarch's well-oiled catering machine devolve into a lurching, rickety Rube Goldberg device. Sometimes Finn overshot lurching, ended up with a god-awful mess. The car, their monstrous olive-green legacy, was stuck in the shop with some undiagnosable auto ailment. There was no logical link to Hector's lucky shot days before. That damn magnetic sign had never stayed properly attached. But it felt like Hector's fault, as if he'd loaded the shingle with malign wishes. The oven had been on all afternoon as she spun from task to task, trying to complete the day's 2 small jobs, one to pick up at 4 and the other to pick up at 6, although she managed to forget who was coming first, quiches or cheesecakes. The quiches were just now cooling, and the cheesecakes were naked, where she'd promised chocolate leaves. Reed had such a special touch, Finn's inherited customers were always saying. Finn, however, did not. Her dishes usually tasted fine, but presentation often failed her. Like these quiches, the 4 of them not quite equally filled, and 2 with crusts baked a smidgen past golden perfection. Finn's forearms, the tips of her braids, and the front of her sundress were crusted with dough. She tugged a thread from the dress's side seam, but when a cup kept coming after 3 inches, she tucked it back in at the armpit. She should have shaved. Finn mixed a tumbler full of vodka and orange juice. She heard Ben in the next room. At least she heard the television, a tennis match she recognized from the hollow, syncopated thwack, wake, thwack of the ball, goofy, hushed voices of the announcers. And there he was, leaning over the coffee table and the disassembled bits of the 5-disc CD changer. I think I've about got this gizmo figured out. He didn't look up, of course, engaged as he was in simultaneously scrutinizing the CD changer's innards and the television. Ben pried at a small metal flap with the tip of a flathead screwdriver. Muscles swam across his back in response to the delicate movements of his hand. It was a long, thin, serious back. His head was quite small, a disproportion exaggerated by a cowlicky mass of ash blonde hair. That's it, Ben murmured as the metal flap loosened. Finn grabbed the remote and punched down the volume. No reaction. Ben's eyes clicked in their sockets as they followed a baseline volley. Finn stood on the countertop. Her dark footsteps made a crazed jitterbug across the flour-powdered floor, and an errant egg lay where it landed, yolk intact. Finn found a paintbrush and a package of rose leaves in a gas pitcher at the back of the top shelf. This was the land of the mostly forgotten, where the cupboards nearly met the ceiling, the place of extra mixing bowls, heavy and chipped, dented copper gelatin molds shaped like pineapple and grape clusters, the rusted graters, warped plastic colanders, and silver serving dishes that weren't worth the bother of polishing the way Tonnerst bloomed overnight. Reed had worked her clients' big parties, serving her masterpieces out of those same gleaming silver dishes. Finn had polished them enough for two lifetimes, and afterwards cleared, cleaned, and put up the leftovers, tireless. Finn delivered the food in Tupperware containers and collected her pieces later, when her car was running. The garage manager seemed to be avoiding her calls. "I'll have him call you, Ms. Finn," one of the mechanics finally promised her. The screen door screeched open. She waited. No slam meant Duncan, Mr. Manners himself. Duncan's genteel manner would have been a sure hit with Reed. He had the Nordic coloring and cheekbones and grace of a Renaissance Danish prince, and the intelligent, tired eyes, gentle voice, and competent hands of a trusted pediatrician. He would have earned points for his shoes, which bore stiff new laces and a burnished cordovan glow. "Good golly," he said, taking in the mess Finn on the counter. That he was gay and high-strung wouldn't have made an impression either way. That he was Finn's only friend, a man with a musical talent so evident that even his habitual low self-esteem was not likely to derail his destiny to be lured from shithole Tuscaloosa, well, Reed would have stopped listening. She took quick measure of a man and rarely found cause to revise it. "Two jobs going at once," Finn replied. "My strong work ethic, you know." "No, really." He started at the butcher block, whisking dough snippets into his palm. Finn climbed down. She stirred the melted chocolate and began to brush it on the underside of a leaf. "Did you see Hector when you came in?" "He's on the porch, drawing and scowling." Duncan raised his eyebrows as the TV volume crept back up. "Doesn't your little friend have a home of his own?" "At least he's not up on the roof again. Someday he's going to put his leg right through." Leaving the edges of the leaves unpainted was crucial, or she'd never get the chocolate off. "What is this, the sixth day in a row?" Duncan persisted. She flicked a brush full of chocolate at him, but it fell short on the table in front of him. He wiped the drops with his finger and licked. "I know, I should be grateful you have such a soft spot for strays. Would you like me to peel your leaves when they cool?" "You weren't a stray," Finn said. "You know, some people hold down jobs or write novels while they write their dissertations." "And what do the other people do?" He shrugged. "Tell me." "Sink into deep, prolonged funks, gain 30 pounds, nap on train tracks," Duncan said. "I'm saying, why are you always defending him? What does he do for you?" "I'm not defending. I'm gathering facts, practicing to be a strict empiricist." Duncan snorted. "You're a soft, soft touch, honey. Don't strain yourself." She pressed a finished leaf into the edge of the cheesecake, too deep. She pried the leaf up with the tip of a paring knife. The screen door screeched and slammed, followed by the high-heeled tippity-tap, tippity-pap of Mrs. Magda Boyd pattering down the hall. "Hello, Fiona. Hector told me to come right in." Magda paused, giving Finn the once-over. "I hope that was all right." There was no sense in feeling sheepish about her appearance. Though Finn knew she looked like hell, almost anyone would look frumpy next to one of these relentlessly coordinated and accessorized matrons. Who would have guessed you could find a pair of sandals, a scarf, and a headband all in precisely the same piercing shade of lime green? "Your quiches are ready to go," Finn said. Magda's eyes nearly crossed as she regarded them. Just a beat went by. "Ooh, they're lovely." Lordy, that's what Finn could count on with these old customers of Reed's, unbending etiquette, unswerving loyalty in the face of slightly flawed work. The TV blared. Duncan worked his thumbs into the instep of Finn's left foot. The chocolate leaves were only slightly askew. The screen door screeched and slammed again. Soft, sneakered footsteps announced the next customer, a younger woman, but no less fashion-conscious. She wore a startling patriotic ensemble, all red, white, and blue, with plenty of stars and stripes, from the tips of her tiny red keds to the navy blue brim of her white golf cap. "Hi, I'm Sandra. I'm not too early, am I?" "Everything's all set." "I'm kind of anxious, over-anxious, I guess. I don't know why I volunteered to host this shower. It's for my husband's. We're newlywed sister. She's very particular. Is that your son on the porch? Nice-looking boy. Nephew." "Pardon?" Sandra raised an eyebrow. "He's my nephew. And this is your..." She pointed to Duncan. Duncan dropped Finn's foot like a hot spoon. "This is my Duncan." "Oh, I remember now about your family." "So tragic," she sighed. He was your sister's, that's right, isn't it? Hector is my sister's son. Someone else died too, right? A terrible accident. My mother and sister were killed. Well, Sundress unsnapped and snapped the clasp on a red patent leather purse. To whom do I make out the check? Everyone's dead, kaput. Finn felt meanness gather like venom in the back of her throat. It's preposterous, really, improbable even as the plot for a made-for-TV movie. Who would believe it? Death by planes, trains, and powerboats. The curse of the sweet leaves. Or should it be sweet leaves, Duncan? I've always wondered about that. Don't you think you're a little hard on her? Duncan plucked a slimy, rootless avocado pit from an old pickle jar on the windowsill. On whom? Sandra? Yes, Sandra, she didn't mean to be so rude. Finn slammed a saucepan into the dishwasher. It's just so tragic. Well, isn't it? Tragic was a flimsy word. Finn's grandfather drowned the year she was born, leaving Reed a widow at 43. Finn's father, Eugene, was lost the same year when the army plane he was on disappeared over the Pacific en route to Saigon. Finn's mother, Ursula, and older sister, Easter, were killed outside New York City when a TV news copter crashed into the Amtrak train they had ridden over 1,000 miles to die on. Theirs were the most spectacular of the sweet leaf deaths so far, and only ones to make the national news, a 15-second aerial shot of the smoking wreck. So when Rita died 3 years ago, that left only Hector's father, Raymond Verone, RV, Reed had dubbed him, Raymond of the Portable Life, who'd been absent from any Sweetleaf's life since he was 15 and his parents whisked him off to Seattle before Easter's pregnancy was common knowledge, as if geography could change the fact of fatherhood. Finn had picked up the phone the day RV snuck away to say his goodbye. He thought he was talking to Easter. I've only got a second. I'm really sorry. I promised to stay in touch. Take care of... After a long pause, he hung up, unable perhaps to say, our child, which was too big, or yourself, which was pitifully small. Finn's palm stuck to the black plastic of the receiver. They still had that phone, a squarish rotary model that survived all insult. Affixing the word tragic, as quick as licking a stamp, implied that what mattered about these deaths was the method or the suddenness rather than loss. Tragic was a concept for public use, something that could be tended to by prayers and casseroles for the bereaved. If only you'd clean as you went, Duncan said, spritzing glass cleaner on the oven door. That gene skipped me, like how I can't curl my tongue. The opening bars of Back in the USSR blared from the stereo. Ramon stood sentinel at the top of the porch steps. Ramon was the orange plaid tomcat who followed Ben everywhere, weighing in at 22 pounds, with one ear mostly bitten off and several sizable bald patches along his flanks, he compensated in loyalty for what he lacked in looks. Their own cat, Hazel, sat hunched beneath Hector's chair. Poor old thing looked like a dirty white slipper. What's you working on? Finn asked Hector through the screen door. Just fiddling around. Finn rested her hand on the door handle. Speaking of god-awful messes, and wasn't that the theme for the day? There was this, a relationship transacted almost entirely in sentence fragment. Beyond thoughts of her estate, what might Reed have imagined for her survivors? Family takes care of family, she always said, although it was really only Reed that took care, a stout 140-pound edifice of family, an edifice that, when removed, left a massive crater. And what did take care mean anyway? The provision of food, clothing, shelter? Bring, bring. 3 1/4 feline ears twitched at the sound of an unusually loud bicycle bell. A bike swerved into view. The cyclist, a white blonde girl, raised her hand to wave. Hey, she called. Braking, she slowed almost to a stop. But then the front tire of the bike slid off the edge of the sidewalk and she teetered, toppled to the ground. Hector dashed down to the girl and scooped her up in his arms. His shaggy brown hair blew off his face. His jaw tightened at the effort of carrying the girl, and beneath the boyish softness of Hector's face, Finn saw the harder face of a man. He gently set the girl down on the couch. Jordis, Finn, Finn, Jordis. Hello, Jordis, Finn said. Jordis's half-smile faded when it became clear no one was going to say anything else. Finn looked into her glass, mostly ice and watered-down orange juice now. She rattled it anyway and slurped down the rest of the liquid. Are you hurt? Finn asked. It's nothing. She held up her elbow, scraped raw. My ankle got twisted a bit. You need ice, Finn said. Hector, run in and get a bag of ice. What about... Ice, please, Finn said. Jordis pointed towards Hector's open sketchbook on the floor. The page was filled with dark pencil drawings of the neighbor's roof, a patch of shingles, the drooping gutter, the slope of the red brick chimney. Hector's an ace, Jordis said. Finn heard the freezer door slam. Yep, he's the artist of the family. Hector bounded down the hall. You're a gem. Jordis kicked off her sandals and stretched out her slim white leg on the couch to receive the bundle of ice. As she turned, the fabric of her jumper pulled tight over her stomach, and for just a moment, before she readjusted, Finn thought she saw the swell of a pregnant belly. Hector pulled a kitchen towel from his back pocket. Here, I grabbed this, too, so it wouldn't feel too cold. A real gentleman. Jordis fluffed her hand through her wispy hair and pulled out a leaf, a tough cookie disguised as an elf. Hector settled back down in the purple chair. Finn grabbed Hazel by the haunches and slid her out from beneath it. She kissed Hazel's smooth, flat forehead and headed back inside for another drink before Hector dismissed her. The kitchen smelled sharply of bleach. Duncan leaned over the sink, applying elbow grease. Stop scrubbing, damn it. I'm just helping, Duncan replied. They're coming back, Ben said. A stiff bunch of hair sprang straight up from the center of his forehead. What a relief, she tried on Jordis's cocky voice. What's up with you? Without breaking eye contact with the TV, he slipped his hand beneath her blouse, ran his palm up her spine as far as he could reach, then dragged his nails down. A cute little doughboy of a player missed an off-balance three-point shot. Shit, these guys are going to blow their playoff spot. Ben grabbed her wrist. You want to watch? He patted the space next to him on the couch. I'm not Ramon. What's that? Hector had returned to sketching. Hazel was curled in Jordis's lap, and Jordis was telling a story. Finn had forgotten about Jordis, hadn't done anything about her wounds. Jordis's story featured an angry dog. She snorted and barked. Finn headed back to the kitchen. The tall vodka rocks waited for her on the table beside a deck of cards. Deal 'em up, partner, Duncan said. His smile fell short. Are you sure you're up for this? You don't have to entertain me. I am miles behind in German, but what'll you do? I'll stand in the fucking dark hallway like a lost child, she thought. A lost child with a stiff drink. Duncan was already dutifully immersed in his textbook, muttering vocabulary words, gutturals catching in his throat like swallowed moths. This is my house, she muttered, as if it weren't filled with people who felt more comfortable there than she did. Why was that again? She ran her tongue over a vodka-slick ice cube, slid down the floor, chewed at the end of her braided ponytail. Well, she wasn't going to go into that, some deep philosophical self-inquisition as to her belongingness here or anywhere else. That was simply boredom, wasn't it? She needed a hobby. Ben punched up the volume. Her ribs vibrated with the bass of the TV. Timeouts, foul shots, commercials, shot clock adjustments. Your team was all but beaten. Still, you had to watch the last 5 minutes unfurled in super slow motion. Abruptly, the TV shut off. Finn forced herself to her feet. Before she reached the door, Hector banged in from the front porch. Would you get me the phone? He wouldn't go in the same room with Ben if there was any way to avoid it. Jordis needs someone to pick her up, since we don't have a car. Have you even called the garage this week? Finn opened the door a crack and grabbed the phone from the couch next to Ben. What's up? Ben asked. A friend of Hector's calling for a ride home. Hector shot her a leave Ben out of this look. She shrugged, sorry. But Ben has caught his cue. He stepped into the hall. I can give your friend a ride home, Hector. I'm just leaving. He patted his head, trying to flatten his cowlicks. Jordis was hopping toward the screen door. Terrific. I'm not even sure my friend is home. Terrific, Hector echoed. I'm parked across the street. Do you have everything, Ben asked Jordis. My bike, she said. Finn looked at Jordis closely. Her elf face was pale. Her dress hung loosely, unrevealingly, from its high waist. I've got it, Hector said, already out the door. Hang on, Ben said. From the yellow room, he retrieved his laptop, his backpack, and another satchel, the literal weight of his dissertation. I guess I've got you, Ben said to Jordis, sweeping her off her feet. Later, Finn, nice to meet you, Jordis said. Ben, his beast of burden, was followed by the sorely outwitted Hector wheeling the bicycle across the street. Ramon pulled up the rear, not sure what was going on, but not going to miss a minute of it. Duncan was out cold, drooling on his notes. His German text lay open, his forefinger pressed to the phrase, Nicht wahr. He had beautiful fingers, wore a modest single gold signet ring. His nails were perfect pearlescent ovals. Finn placed her right hand beside his. Hers was the coarse hand of a field worker, chapped with torn cuticles and chocolate beneath her nails as black as dirt. Duncan, honey, you're asleep. He nodded yes. He let Finn lead him to her bed, where he obediently lay down on top of his covers. The screen door screeched open and closed quietly. She heard the faint click of Hector's bedroom door shutting. Finn kissed Duncan on the forehead. Sleep tight. Finn turned off the lamp and picked up the melted ice bag and towel. Hector had left his sketchbook on the purple chair. Finn flipped through the pages, more crooked chimneys, Ramon's fat, skewed face, then several pages of feet, fingers, elbows, half of Jordis's face. Was there something to be made of the fact that Hector didn't draw anything whole? Or was this some adolescent something or other? Her constant question. How much of his hermetically sealed, won't say one word when none would do, holier than thin attitude was an unpleasant but normal developmental stage, and how much reflected real and utter disdain? Or was there an option C? She flipped off the overhead light. The hall was black except for a tooth of light from beneath Hector's door at the end. Let me in. She imagined the wood beneath her knuckles, the sound of her own knocking, his startled, muffled response. In the yellow room, Finn wiped Ben's fingerprints from the top and sides of the CD unit and straightened the cords. An unkempt stack of notes was stacked beneath the couch. She picked up his sweating ice cube tray from where it sat on the coffee table just beside a plastic coaster. A wet, dark circle marked the wood. Tsk, tsk. Scallywag, that was a good read-worthy word for Ben. They met because she'd ordered a box of hemp candles from a young woman at the farmer's market who said she'd deliver them later in the week. But her husband was the delivery man. Ben parked the Blue Valiant illegally in front of the house, and Finn hurried inside to get the money. When she got back, Ben was looking wistfully through the porch window into the yellow room. Do you have cable? He asked. Finn nodded. Can I check a score? It was Phillies versus Cubs, top of the 10th, tied 2-2. Finn squeezed lemons for lemonade. They sat together on the couch and sipped it as the pitchers dueled. 11th inning, 12th. During a commercial, he switched off the sound and brought her palm to his face and sniffed. She felt something give way, like the bottom of a wet grocery bag. It could have been fear or desire. She put the tip of her thumb in his mouth, scraped the nail against his bottom teeth. When he finally left that day, the Cubs having pulled off a victory in the bottom of the 13th, Ben asked, maybe we could watch another game together? Was she supposed to think he'd masterminded it that first day, how he'd become her intermittent lover, couch sitter, and fixer of broken objects? And so what if he had? Some people thought ahead, and some people, wasn't that the rap on Finn, didn't. Ben was a curiosity, a hungry soul, an injured bird. He was an orphan with a gift for stories and a love of baseball. Finn admired baseball's inherent laziness, the way it failed to be regular. She leaned against Ben on the couch as he told her about three-finger Mordecai Brown, who had mangled his hand in a corn grinder as a child in his uncle's farm, and then as a young man worked in a coal mine before he began playing baseball at the advanced age of 24, how he'd risen from infielder to ace pitcher when he learned to put a nasty spin on the ball, pitching off the stub of his pinky, and Heinie Manouche, a hot-headed, hard-hitting lefty, the first player to be ejected from a World Series game. Disputing an out, he'd grabbed the umpire's bow tie, fastened with an elastic band, and then released it with an historic snap. Ben told her other stories, family stories, his mother dying after a long battle with breast cancer, her curious last words, the answer is Mr. Mustard. As he spoke, he rubbed Finn's breast, slow, gentle circles that made her skin buzz. Dad ordered a satellite dish. He was determined not to miss another season of college basketball. When it was finally delivered, he was not about to wait to put it up. No matter that the sky was green-black. I yelled at him to come down as the first raindrops hit my face, but the NIT preseason tourney was starting that night. I've almost got it, he said. I'll be right in. The man helped invent this terrifically elegant optic device, one of the key elements of the Hubble telescope, and he stands on the edge of the roof in an electrical storm, holding a metal dish in his hands. What did Ben do for her? Her three most recent couplings, the visiting boy next door, the UPS man, the piano tuner, had been shortest. She couldn't remember the last time when she'd been with anyone for more than a couple months. That Ben was married and a chronic underachiever, and no one else much seemed to like him. So what? Until now, what had mattered was that he was still there. Wasn't that what Duncan appreciated about her? That she was present and accounted for? Even Hector would have to acknowledge, wouldn't he, that for all her faults, she was there and everyone else had left or died? She stood in the hallway again. Hector's light was still on. She remembered the glimpse she'd seen of the man-to-be in Hector's face. She thought maybe she'd seen it again in the hallway, his jaw rigid with frustration with her and being forced to interact with Ben and Ben so sweetly oblivious. Finn had been believing, or had decided to believe, that she still had time with Hector, time to set things right. She knew that a man's disapproval might be irrevocable, but she hadn't made herself even hazard a guess as to how long that might be. Was it calendar years, calendar pages, a lunar cycle, the toe-tapping hours she seemed to spend in the grocery store each week, an inning, the timer ticking off for a soft-boiled egg? Hector's light switched off, a rebuke, as if he knew she was thinking about him. He'd hate it when he realized he left his sketchbook out for her to see. Thank you.